Hello, everyone. This is Renee Rentmeester. I'm the creator and executive producer of the Cooking Without Looking TV show and our podcast. We like to say that we're changing the way we see blindness. And this morning, we're going to talk a little bit about guide dogs and their true meaning and the bond with the people who own them. And, you know, that they are the dogs are in many ways protectors, but there is an amazing bond between the person and the guide dog. Today we have Philip Magelnik, sorry Phil, and Anuradha Kashmircek. Is that good?
Excellent.
Works for me.
It's the little bit of Polish I have in me that came out. They are up from Connecticut. They're also, Phil, you're president of the NFB Southwest Connecticut. Is that correct?
Southwest chapter and vice president of the state affiliate.
Okay, cool. Well, tell us a little bit more about yourself. You guys are engaged, and that's cool. And I think a lot of people might not understand what that's like because you both are legally blind, correct?
Correct. We both have retinitis pigmentosa. I, at the moment, only have light and dark perception, not really any movement or usable sight. Anuradha is behind me with respect to a little bit more sight, and she can explain what she sees on her own. But, yeah, we met because of a guide dog 4 years ago. I had just been accepted to the Fidelco Guide Dog Foundation to receive one of their German Shepherd guide dogs. And I posted it on Facebook, made a comment. And unbeknown to me, Anuradha and I were friends on Facebook and in a same Facebook group for retinitis pigmentosa. And she sent me a message about, hey, how do you get a guide dog? And I asked to speak rather than message back and forth. It's not my forte. And we spoke, and she liked to say, I spoke for an hour. And she was just listening. Like now, and I determined that, you know, she lives an hour away. She uses her last name on Facebook as her dog's name, Zula. So when the screen reader reads Anuradha Zula very quickly, it sounded like a Japanese male. But when I heard her voice, like, you're not a Japanese male. And that was on a Wednesday, and that Saturday coming up was the NFB Connecticut State Convention. And it was going to be the first one I attended, and I just, you know, offered, hey, why don't you meet me up there? And we met, and we left the convention, said goodbye, and then the next week I reached out to her, and we were both in transitional periods of our lives, and jokingly I said, hey, why don't you come down for dinner? I wasn't really an independent traveler yet, just using my cane skills. And she's like, okay, and I didn't know what to do. So I Ubered her down, I met her at the train station, and we walked downtown, and she thought it was all staged. And I'll let her explain why. And then, you know, the following...
I'm going to... Don't run too fast, because okay. I think that the best part was how we found each other at the train station.
Yeah.
Which was we were on the phone and he was trying to flash light somewhere and he goes, can you see me? Can you see me? And, you know, being night blind, the lights, there's a lot of lights everywhere. And with retinitis pigmentosa in a more advanced stage, you do not see depth perception. So you don't know how far the lights are or which one's in the front, which one's higher up and lower. So that didn't work very well. And then Phil decided that he's going to use his handy dandy safety whistle that he carries.
Oh boy.
So when he started whistling, and I'm like, okay, just, you know, I'll come up toward the ground. And Phil didn't know that he was actually on top of the stairs. And I came up from the bottom of the stairs. And when he heard my voice, he went forward. That's without Chloe, just with his cane, and he kind of tripped and tumbled, lost the cane, and he ended up straight in my arms.
Oh, he fell for
so
you.
I think, So I think that's that's the, I think, cute romantic way of falling in love.
It was love at worst sight.
We're a bunch of punsters today.
Absolutely.
Oh my God. What a story. That's an amazing story. Well,
yeah,
well,
that was November 2016. And Christmas 2017, we got engaged. And then the following summer, we bought our home together.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah,
what
no
a
rush.
Great... No.
Absolutely no rush.
No.
But I think we did what I would consider speed dating because I was inadvertently losing my job and had a lot of time on my hands. So we very quickly became inseparable. And I would say the amount of time that we spent together year one would maybe equal to, in some cases, people dating for 5 years. So
that's
really
meant to
learned,
be.
Yes, yeah, so we really learned everything there was to know about each other within a very short period of time.
And she stayed with me.
Hey, there you go. That's the best part, right? Well, tell us, Honorata, tell us a little bit about yourself. Prefill.
I came from Poland to the United States in 1988. I have decided really early on in high school that I wanted to become an art teacher, not knowing that I am going to be losing my eyesight and dealing with everything that I'm dealing with right now. And I am a graduate of University of Hartford, Hartford Art School, and I became an art teacher and taught in a middle school for 15 years. I wish it was more. But, you know, the career was filled with a lot of, I want to say, challenges and rewards. In the last couple years, it was more challenging than rewarding as everything was changing. In my world, the vision was, you know, my vision was declining rapidly. I was looking into possible guide dog, but I was told that I need to do mobility training first. So I took that on in 2013 and worked diligently on my cane and mobility skills in effort to eventually get a guide dog. I have my whole family here, my only brother in Rocky Hill. I have two daughters, Veronica and Sarah, and lots of support from them, as well as Phil's daughters. I think we've been both embraced by the family as we got together and clicked in. And when Phil posted about his, him getting a guide dog, I was very interested as I had not spoken to anyone who was in the process of getting one. In my private life, aside the arts, I really enjoyed independent hiking and kayaking and bicycling and a bunch of sports, but I really, everything was started falling off my plate, and I had to file it in a cabinet called I used to. And the life became very challenging as there was less and less things that I was able to do. And what I didn't know was that, you know, you have to learn how to live blind, how to do everything in a using blind skills. And it wasn't until I became a client of Bureau of Services for the Blind in our state and learned some of those skills, but most importantly, when I became a member of the National Federation of the Blind, I started learning rapidly all those skills from other people. So that was what really catapulted me into being more independent. And there is no stopping in learning. When you learn some skills, there's always some new skills that are still ahead. And you know, with respect to the guide dog, I think when I met Phil, and he expressed his love for German Shepherds, but also said that he was allergic to it, and I'm like, well, I'm not sure how that's gonna work because I have a German Shepherd. If he's allergic,
oh yeah, I know.
You know,
wow.
This might not work out, but you know, we tested it by him coming over and you know, hanging out with my Zula, who is now six, and he survived. He didn't have to use his EpiPen or inhalers any more than he normally would, and it worked. So we were very, I think, lucky that we literally fell into each other's arms and and we made it. We are making it work every day.
Oh, I love it. I love that story. Well, Phil, so tell us what happened when you got the guide dog. How did you go about getting the guide dog?
Sure. Let me just preface that by really echoing the tone and tenor of what Honorata just mentioned. You know, the ability to change our approach and how we do things is as fundamental as it is frustrating and scary. I was 42 when my sight, you know, made me legally blind. And before that, I was, you know, active. I was a volunteer firefighter, an EMT, 20 years as a police dispatcher. And
wow.
When I retired, it was the big pity party and, well, I got a great pension. Why kill myself and do something? So it was like that until my kids went to college. And I'm like, okay, now what? And I had done some stand-up comedy, a reality TV show that went belly up before it aired. We almost had a family reality show based on a father going blind, which ended up tanking as well. But it gave me some inspiration and courage to do different things, and that's how I fell into the advocacy. But I soon realized that, you know, I had to come out of my shell and start traveling on my own a little bit more. And that's when I started thinking about the guide dog. You know, kids are in college, I'm living alone, I want to get out more, let's get the dog. So I applied to the Fidelco Guide Dog Foundation, which is essentially in our backyard, about an hour and a half away in Bloomfield, Connecticut. And I always loved German Shepherds. Yes, I did have allergies, but 2 years before I applied, I knew I was going to apply. I began very aggressive immunotherapy and allergy shots. And that seemed to have taken hold because now we have three German Shepherds in the house.
Oh, wow.
Surviving. So I applied for Fidelco. It was very nerve-wracking because it was like applying for a mortgage with all the documentation and testimonials and letters of recommendation and doctor's reports. But I was approved pretty quickly. The next step was having someone from Fidelco, a trainer, come to my house and just see what I do, where I live, where I walk. Simulate a guide dog walk by the trainer holding on to the harness. It's called a Juno walk, and I'm walking, and it's, I'm sure people were driving by looking at us like, why is this lady holding this thing and this guy's holding it and they're walking and she's tugging it and pulling it to make sure I had the strength to correct the dog and different paces, you know, fast and slow, crossing a street, up a sidewalk. It was pretty odd, but I passed that apparently. And then it was a waiting game, like expecting a child. And it took a little over a year, and I got the phone call. It's like, hey, we have a dog. I know you wanted a male, but we have a female who will be a perfect match. Would you like to see her? Like, who am I to say no? And the following Monday, they showed up with Chloe, and Honorata, myself, and her daughter Sarah came around the corner, and she had the video rolling. And it was just tail wagging and licks on the face, and she had me. So we began our formal training that next Monday, the 11th of December. And it'll be 3 years in December that I've had her.
Wow.
And I just got very emotional because that day Chloe actually rolled over onto her back to let Phil pet her. And I haven't seen that her do that to any stranger that she just randomly meets. So she really chose him.
Well, the trainer, Becky, who brought her and then did our training in home, actually said she never saw this dog get, not emotional, but interact with someone like that. So it was meant to be, I guess. And, you know, the one thing about Fidelco, which I loved, is that they do home training, where most guide dog schools, you go to them and stay 3 to 4
right.
weeks, and you're in a dorm, and you're with other, you know, group classes and some individual. With Fidelco, they come to where I live, and that gives me a lot more, experience and confidence to use the guide dog, because I know where I am, so it's a little bit comforting, and
right.
seeing how the dog is in my back, you know, environment, I think it's very helpful, because I know many people have gone to the guide dog schools, did great, they come home, and they're not working together well.
It's a whole different world.
Exactly. So this is great. And if we have trouble, you know, they're around the corner. So we've, you know, have a good relationship with Fidelco, and that led us to getting the puppy.
Well, I'm sorry, Anuradha.
That's okay. No, I just wanted to add that I think a really huge moment for me was because I often just wanted to follow Phil during training and just kind of see what he's going to be learning and, you know, thinking about how in the future I am going to also have a guide dog, what I'm going to need to know. And I think the huge cry, and I'm crying right now, but the huge Aww. Moment was when Phil requested Becky, the trainer, to see if he can train with Chloe at night, because a lot of time he preferred to do night walking over daytime because he had light sensitivity. And when they went for their first training, Chloe just took off with him, walking around the poles and the hydrants, and you know, he walked faster than he ever did before, and he stopped. I don't know if Phil wants to finish.
No, it's okay.
She stopped him before the intersection, and he just stood there and he broke out crying because he felt so much freedom and relief, but also joy from being able to do that and not feel, you know, slowed down by the cane. So that was a really amazing experience, and I was really happy that I was there with him during that time.
Now, how do you guys let go and just give your full faith to your guide dog as you're walking around town or in your neighborhood?
It was tough at the beginning. You know, the training was really intense, and it was during the beginning of the winter in 2017, and there was ice and snow, and we'd go out at 8 in the morning, and it would be 10 degrees outside. So it really was like a boot camp.
Oof.
And I was a little bit lazy at the time, so a lot of that walking, it was like I got home, and I was falling asleep at 5 in the afternoon. But it was helpful because we did go to the train platform and was taught how to trust her. And we actually would, you know, I'd be perpendicular to the platform and walk straight and the dog would stop. Or we'd be in a busy intersection downtown and she said, okay, let's go. And the dog would not take me into traffic. So that gave me the confidence to say, well, this dog really knows what she's doing. It's just me who needs to get used
mm-hmm.
to it. And the trust just grew over and over. And 2 months after having her, we actually flew down to Washington, D.C. to hit Congress with the Federation and do some lobbying. And in the airport, you know, JFK Airport in New York is a mess. And it had to be like a 20-minute walk to the airport. And I had Chloe, and Hunter Rod had an assistant. And she was just weaving through the crowd. I never felt like I was going to brush against anything. Our travels on the train, at the hotel, you know, knowing after one shot how to get in and out of the hotel and where to go to the bathroom. It was remarkable. So she earned her trust. I don't know if she fully trusts me, because when we're walking by our house intentionally, just taking a walk around the block, she'll want to turn into our driveway and she'll slow down like, hey, we're over here. Hello. So I think her goal is to get me home safely. So when I don't do that, she tries to correct me, which is interesting.
And something that I noticed, Renee, was that although in Stanford there were times when, you know, she showed maybe some hesitation or uncertainty with respect to what Phil wanted her to do, but when we made our first trip to New York City just to explore and go out to restaurants, Chloe was totally in her element. She, Times Square was nothing to her. She loved it. And at that time, we didn't know why she felt so confident in New York. And it turned out later on that that's where she was actually raised by her puppy raiser.
Wow. Now, you guys are raising a puppy right now. Is that true?
That's true. Phil had agreed to my crazy idea.
I don't know why.
raising a puppy in effort to, you know, with a small chance for that to happen, but still a chance that we have, you know, taken to raise a puppy in effort for it to become my guide dog. And the I understood what I was going into, because when the dog goes to training, they have to have the stamina. They have to have pass medical tests. You know, they have to have a clean medical record. They have to have strong bones. They have to have you know, strong personality. They cannot be too timid or aggressive. So, you know, when you get a puppy to raise, you don't know, you know, who that dog is. It's kind of like when you have a baby, you don't know who that baby is going to become. And ultimately, in something that I do understand now very well, a dog, no matter how much training they go through, they have to ultimately, aside being fit for the job, they have to choose to be a guide dog. They can choose not to. They can just, you know, sit on the side of the curb and say, I'm not doing this. So for anyone who sees a working guide dog, this is what that dog loves to do. Mm-hmm. The dogs are not forced to work. They're taught how to do it, but they do have a will. And I am very hopeful that the puppy that we are raising right now is going to choose to be a guide dog. And, you know, if it's not going to be for me, maybe for someone else. But I'm, you know, hoping that he's going to be my guide.
How much longer do you have training? Oh, I'm sorry, Phil.
No. I was going to say that our puppy is actually larger than my Chloe. He's about 75 pounds at a year and 3 months.
Whoa.
How much longer? We've had him for over a year, and
a year this week, honey.
A year.
Oh, wow, congratulations.
And he has been showing a lot of growth, but he recently got neutered, and during the time of 2 weeks of not working, there's a lot of challenges because he's, you know, bored. He cannot, you know, go outside and work, and he cannot play in the backyard, which is what dogs do during training, and even guide dogs. They have a lot of play time when they're not working. But he has been scheduled to go for his formal training at Fidelco, which we call the Fidelco College. Sometimes, I was told, between the end of November and early January. It's a really big block of time, which kind of is created because of the pandemic. There is a backlog of dogs that they have right now that need to be placed, but they're unable to place the dogs in the right states. So we have to wait until, you know, they clear some of the dogs from the premises and from living with the trainers for the new dogs to go into the training. But Yes, so somewhere between November and January is when he's going to go in for the formal training. And that during the formal training, I am not going to be able to have any contact with him. So I might hear about how he's doing, but not be able to see him.
Oh, that's interesting. Why is that?
This is the time when they have to focus on their work. They have to learn to work with other people, and there's they go through neurostimulation and other stuff. And typically, a puppy raiser has only a job to raise the puppy for that 1 year. And at the end of the formal training, when they graduate, the puppy raiser can come for the graduation ceremony and see the dog before they're placed with a handler. You know, and the hard part that we are learning is to, you know, raise a puppy for 1 year just to see it go off and hopefully, you know, away and serve. But, you know, we don't, puppy raisers don't know if their dog is going to eventually become a guide dog or if they're going to be maybe have a change of career and end up being a tracking dog or, you know, a bomb sniffing dog. The dog ultimately will choose what they want to do. But German Shepherds are working dog. And they really love work, so whatever they choose to do is what they are best at. They cannot be forced to guide or they cannot be forced to track. So Fidelco trainers ultimately figure out what is the best career for them.
Now, do you notice that dog looking at Chloe and sort of as a model of what to do?
I want to say partially yes, but I think each shepherd has their own mind and their own energy. So although he learns from both of the other dogs, he has his own agenda. But something really cute that they do in a house is they barter. They bring their toys when there's something else that they want. And they do it with us and they do it with each other. So if one has a toy that the other one wants, they don't just go for it and try to interrogate. They'll bring something else and make it look appealing to try to get the other dog to give up what they have to take the toy that they're making a deal. They're
Absolutely.
Making a deal, and it's really, really interesting. I don't know if other shepherds do that or if it's just the three of ours, but it's pretty cool.
Well, Phil, tell us in your own words the feeling that you have for your guide dog, the relationship deep down with the guide dog.
Sure, that's an interesting question. Sometimes I feel like she is a tool, just like my cane. You know, I use her to get around. And then on the other end of the spectrum is that she's a very loyal, dog to me. So most times it's somewhat in the middle where I know she has her job to do and I don't want to distract her from doing that or have other people distract her from doing her job because that gets in the way of my safety. But on the other end, coming to me when she hears my voice, she'll wag her tail like crazy. If I go somewhere without her, I think I have more separation anxiety than she does. She doesn't mind hanging out with the other dogs in the house, but she'll come to the door and say, "Hey, why aren't you taking me?" So it's a very unique relationship. I know that a lot of people post on social media or state that, you know, their dog is their whole world. And maybe because we're so busy with a lot of things, I don't have that sense. But I do know her worth and her value. And, you know, when she comes anywhere she is in the house, I say, "Chloe, come here," she'll come find me. So it is a bond that is of trust. She knows I won't put her into harm's way. And likewise, I know she won't do that for me. But it's really unique. It's really hard to put into words. And I'm usually not at a loss for words.
Well, guys, you guys sent me a baked ziti recipe, and then you put a little note on it, Phil, something about, well, this is something we make and we don't burn it. You guys are the Cooking Without Looking TV show recipe of the day. Tell us a little bit about your cooking together.
That's whoever interesting. I'm really great at making reservations and Uber Eats orders. That's my thing.
Your forte.
I did do so much cooking when I could see, and then I kind of just fell out of it. And now, there are certain things I'll do simple. Like, I'd rather make a sandwich and make a bowl of pasta. So my tendencies with respect to cooking have changed. Honorata, on the other hand, will try to make anything. And now I'm like, well, you should really only do your big cooking the day before we have the cleaning lady come over. Because I called her, like in Cinderella, when they throw the bippity-boppity-boo and throw that, or maybe Snow White, throw the fairy dust all over the place. That's what it looks like with Mrs. Dash. It's like she's just flinging it here, flinging it there. But honey, yeah, tell about your cooking skills.
Being sighted, I really enjoyed doing cooking from scratch, and that's how I was raised and brought up, so I do not pop a soup out of the can. I really still prefer to do that, and I don't find blindness to be too much of an obstacle with respect to, you know, knowing your ingredients and mixing them together, following directions. But the challenge that we face is that the appliances themselves are not accessible and intuitive. So we have a glass cooktop in a house that we bought a couple years ago. And no matter how we mark it, it's very difficult for us to find the middle of the heat spot and, putting the pot directly on it, or me still trying to use the little sight I have, I might not see that the frying pan is off to the side, and I'll just put my, let's say, breaded cutlet directly on the cooktop. So that has happened. It was well done.
She tried to blame my dog. She tried to blame that Chloe jumped up and ate a chicken breast. I'm like, no, it's just was never cooked.
Yeah, so there's some challenges and obstacles, and we did invest in an Instapot, and that's somewhat difficult to use as well because of the buttons, but there is a Wi-Fi option with the app. I still have to explore that, but I do really enjoy making soups, homemade soups. So for me, trying to get the ingredients together and mixing it in the right way, it's not an issue. But knowing when something is done and when it's time for the next ingredient, it's more of a challenge than it used to be, especially with the meats. Using the talking thermometer, it's very important. And I had to learn that from Phil because I didn't know what the temperature is supposed to be because I was using my side before and the fork and just knew when something was done.
Looked done.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, do
but
you
Phil
ever
is
just...
very good with his Phil is very good with his George Foreman grill also.
Well, I want to add, one of my greatest cooking experience was about a year and a half ago, Honorata and I were invited by President Mark Riccobono of the NFB, who you had on your show recently. We were at leadership seminar down in Baltimore with him, and the first evening we were there was a five-day event, and they bring us down to Baltimore, and we stay at the Institute. And he's like, you guys ready for dinner? We're like, yeah. He goes, okay, you got to cook it. We're like, oh, boy. So we all put on our sleep shades so that we're all on even playing field for sight, because there's so many varying degrees of sight or lack thereof. And we marched out onto the deck, and they had grills already set up, and we reached our hand into a bucket, grabbed a steak, put it in a basket. And he's like, okay, if you want this well, it's 4 minutes and on each side. And we put it in the basket, flipped it. He squirted some oil on there just to scare us a little bit, and this flame shot up. We walked back into the dining room, and it was the best steak I ever had. I mean, it was the first time I really cooked a steak on my own, not being able to see. And it's like, wow. And that was the first night to give us that confidence and almost like some camaraderie that we all did this together. Now, Honorata does not eat steak, so she chickened out. And I kept trying to say, just chickened make out. One, I'll eat it. Just make it, I'll eat it. And she wouldn't do it.
I'll make vegetables.
Well, there
it
you
was,
go.
It was a cool experience. And that also, that trip to Baltimore changed the trajectory of our lives because we really got to immerse ourselves in the organized blind movement. And we feel a debt of gratitude to those who came before us and those now, you know, doing the heavy lifting to make sure that the rights of the blind and disabled at large are, you know, not trampled upon.
And that's important, too. That's, you know, because people often do not think about it. You just think, and it's like you have to call their attention. Well, look at, you know, I think one of the things that Mark said, which was pretty cool, it's like, oftentimes businesses won't hire people who are blind because they say, well, you know, we have to do these special accommodations for them. Mm-hmm. But he said, well, light in a building is a special accommodation for a sighted person.
Yep. So there's a lot of things. It's education. And yes, it gets frustrating because we've been to a lot of doctors recently and even medical staff just not knowing what to do or how to give directions or approach us has been very difficult. But we learn, and if we try to reach out to those with authority to help make change, then that's our best way of getting in there. And, you know, we offer all the time, hey, if you want us to come speak at your lunch and learn, we'll come. If you want us to help you develop something, we'll do it. So we offer ourselves all the time to assist with that. And since this is a cooking show, you know, restaurants have been our greatest learning experience and teaching experience because we'll walk in. And when Honorata and I first met, we were at a restaurant, and she asked the host or the waiter if she could grab his elbow as he brought us to the table. And he said, of course. But he didn't realize as she was walking, you know, a little bit behind her, him and to the right, that he kept walking and she slammed into a big pillar in the middle of the aisle.
Oh, no.
Because he didn't know to bring her around it. And she got a free creme brulee out of it. And that was her first word. She whacks her head really hard. And we sit down at the table. The manager comes over. And she's like, I hope I can get a free creme brulee out of this. And she did.
That was with a huge bag of crushed ice on my forehead.
Oh, my God. Well, you know what happens?
Sometimes it's better to just stay and cook at home, yes.
Well,
but in restaurants, it's hit or miss. And we have some places to go to who know us, and they're awesome. And some places, you know, it's not the employee's fault, although you can say common sense should be common sense. But we just try to gently educate or let them know the way of doing things.
Yes, for the sighted people, I would say that there's two very important questions that they need to remember to ask any disabled or blind person. And the first one is, do you need help? Mm-hmm. And the second one would be, if the answer is yes, how may I help you?
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two most important things in the relationship and etiquette of how the sighted people can interact or properly should interact with someone who is disabled.
With a visible disability.
Yes.
A visible disability, yeah.
Right. Because otherwise, you know, you think about it from the blind person's point of view, and someone just grabs you because they think you need help without saying anything. Oh, my God, that would just send me through the roof. Like, but what did you just do to me?
Happens all the time. I was at a doctor's visit last week. And my mother had brought me there. Honorata was busy in the house. Usually we travel together. And the person just looked over me. Can he get into a gown? Why is he here today? I'm like, I'm here. I can hear you. It was like, can he register himself? Or the worst was when I was asked, do you know your date of birth? I'm like, you're kidding me.
Oh,
so it takes
God.
All of me to bite my tongue, and I have many scars on it.
Well, guys, share your recipe with us before you go. It was a great recipe,
sure.
The Big Ziti.
Sure. You'll think you'll be posting it, but it's very simple. It doesn't require a lot of equipment, a lasagna pan or a baking dish, a roll of aluminum foil, and then the ingredients, you know, a box of pasta. You can use rotini, you can use ziti, you can use anything you want, one box of that. For sauce, I'm half Italian and half Ukrainian, but I've never made sauce. So if you don't have any sauce my mom made is Italian, then we'll just buy, I found, the highest quality jarred sauce you can buy. Don't get the 99-cent store brand if you can afford it, obviously.
And our favorite is Newman's Own marinara sauce.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a good sauce. And I get 2 jars of that, sometimes 3, a 2-cup bag of shredded cheese, either mozzarella or they have a pizza blend, which has a couple of different cheeses, which is really good, and ricotta cheese. And most, I think 2 cups is the most, 2 pints. So rather than buying a quart container, I'll buy 2 pints, because if I don't have to use it, I won't have to open it. And I'll save it for another time. And then it's simple. Boil the pasta as you would
any
other
job.
Pasta. That's her job. Boil the pasta. Then she drains the pasta, puts it back into the pot, and then hands it to me. And then I'll add 1 jar of sauce. I'll mix in a pint of the ricotta cheese. I'll add in a huge handful, which is probably close to 1 cup, of the shredded cheese mix, and I'll mix it in. And usually it turns kind of a pinkish, I was told, or it used to be when I could see. And then I start my layering process. There's a way where, as you mentioned earlier, we could just pour the whole thing into the baking dish and bake it. But I prefer to do it in layers so that I can get more sauce and cheese in between so it stays moist and stays nice and cheesy. So I'll layer half of the mixture or fill up half of the baking dish with the mixture. Then I'll open that 2nd jar of sauce and I'll spread some over the top and spoon it across so it's a nice layer of sauce. Then that cheese again, take it out, hand sprinkle it all over it like I'm making a pizza. And then I'll add the 2nd layer of pasta mix and then do the same thing. Coat it with some sauce, nice heavy on the cheese on top, wrap it in aluminum foil on the top, stick it in an oven. The oven had been preheated for 350. It's roughly about 1 hour. You'll smell if it's burning. And then we'll take the aluminum foil off the top so it can brown a little bit and make that nice gooiness even better. Take it out, let it rest a little bit, and usually sometimes we get lazy and actually order a salad to have with it and some garlic bread. But, you know, that's it, and everybody loves it. When we have parties with people over, that's one of our go-to dishes because it's affordable, it's very easy to make, and a tray can last, you know, 3-4 days, you know, for a couple of meals.
Oh, and, man, that sounds great.
That's my Italian go-to. That's my Italian go-to.
And it goes really well with the chicken cutlets that I make, right?
If you say so. No, that's the one thing. I love, you know, chicken cutlets, and she'll make that a lot. And I finally, after 4 years almost, convinced her, because she gets really frying on the stovetop. It is difficult for us sometimes, and I'm afraid the oil is splashing all over the place and her getting hurt. So I said, you can bake it, you know, because I was a kid using shake and bake. And it's
same concept. Right.
You don't need shake and bake. Just, you know, grab the chicken, dredge it, you know, egg batter, egg and milk, and dredge it in some flour and breadcrumbs, throw it in the oven and bake it. And she did that. It was like a miracle. Like, oh, my God, look at that. So
it was good. It was good. And the secret was the talking thermometer.
that's one thing, yeah. I get frustrated with that also because, again, I'm used to looking at my steak and seeing if it's pink inside because I don't like it pink. I want it well done. And, yes, we're going by a thermometer, but it's different. I'm always thinking, is it undercooked? Is it overcooked? So is the temperature really what I want? And I'd rather look at the, you know, hey, this fried up good or this baked well or this grilled to perfection. So we have to adjust how we do things and change our approach. And it's not always a quick process. You know, a lot of ego involved with me. Like, that's not done. But it was perfect.
Well, guys, to end this, it was really enjoyable to be with you two. How can people reach out to you if they'd like to find out more, especially about how to find out to get a guide dog for a friend or family member?
Oh, I'm sorry to cut you off.
No, you didn't.
I had a break in my phone for a moment. We have a very easy email address we both share. It's called theblindvoices@gmail.com. The Blind Voices, theblindvoices, just like it sounds, theblindvoices@gmail.com. And that's what we do when we're not working with the Federation or committees in local government here. We call ourselves the Blind Voices, and our hope is to soon create a nonprofit with that tag in order to fill the gap of needs that blind people have, which are not being met by government agencies or other nonprofit organizations. Because we do see that big gap. So our hope is to get in there and do that, raise some money for education and products and services for those who need them and aren't getting them from any other source. So theblindvoices@gmail.com is the best way to get a hold of us. We are both on Facebook as The Blind Voices and as our names. You know, Philip McGalmick, there's only one of me in the country, and Honorata Kazmierczak. I think she's the only one. Honorata Zula.
Z-U-L-A.
Z-U-L-A. But definitely email us. We'd love to connect to you. And if people live in other states and are struggling with blindness, we'd love to help refer them to people we know all over the country with the Federation and just be a sounding board for any concerns they may have or recommendations we have for them. Or, you know, sharing of resources. We really are big into that. And we have helped people from near homeless with showing up at our house with a cane with no tip on it to those who are really, really well off and well educated and well careered but have no clue how to deal with blindness. So we've gone through the spectrum of blindness and the socioeconomic lives that come with that. So we just want to really help as many people as we can. And part of that is being on, you know, local, national, and international radio interviews, periodicals. And I think one of our highlights was being on the cover of a Yale alumni magazine with two students we helped in creating an orientation mobility device for the blind a couple of years back. So that was pretty cool.
But, wonderful.
Yeah, anything we do to help, theblindvoices@gmail.com, we are here.
That sounds great. Thanks, guys. It's really been enjoyable speaking with you today. We've been with Philip McGalnick and Honorata Kazmierczak. And
wow.
Did I get it this time? This has been Renee Rentmeester, Cooking Without Looking, the TV show and podcast. We're changing the way we see blindness. And again, if you want to reach out to us, our website is at cookingwithoutlookingtv.wordpress.com. Have a wonderful day. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for hosting us.
Oh, my pleasure.